Can't Wait for Christmas is a proud member of the Christmas Podcast Network.
Hey, buddy, what you doing?
Is it Christmas yet?
No, sorry, not yet.
I can't wait for Christmas.
Yeah, I can't wait for Christmas either. In fact, let's celebrate now.
Welcome to the Can't Wait for Christmas podcast.
It's May 25th, 2024, and that means there's 7 months left until Christmas. Today on the show, we'll play another round of everyone's favorite game, Is It a Christmas Movie? As we look at the 1984 film, Gremlins. We'll also give you a tip on how Christmas can keep you safe, and Ken from The Sounds of Christmas stops by to give us his top 5 picks for Christmas movies where music is essential to the story. Okay, let's start the show! Welcome, Yule Believers, to the Can't Wait for Christmas podcast, the podcast all about Christmas history, Christmas traditions, Christmas media, and everything else Christmas. I'm your host and guy who definitely shouldn't eat after midnight, Tim Babb. I want to start off the show with a brief apology to anybody who's written into our email address, christmas@tancast.com, over the past year or so. The account has been really clogged with spam emails, so I think I might have missed some of your legit emails in there. I went back and found one from, like, May of last year, so clearly I'm not doing a good enough job of weeding out the spam so that I can see your guys' emails, but I am working on it, and so if you send an email going forward, I have a much better chance of seeing it. So again, apologies if I've missed your emails over the past year or so. But now I am curating my inbox better so I can see them more clearly. And speaking of seeing things more clearly, let's move on to our first segment. We need a little Christmas, now!
We need a
So, for the last year, I've been trying to lead a less sedentary lifestyle. I didn't used to do a lot of moving around, sitting behind a keyboard all day, so I've started walking, and I do about 3 to 4 miles a day, which is not amazing, but it's way better than a year ago when I would often not even walk a single mile in a day.
What does this have to do with Christmas?
I'll tell you, imaginary listener. Sounds kind of like Kermit the Frog.
The name is Carl!
Well, usually I walk in the morning, but sometimes I don't get around to it till late at night. But even though the weather is fine for walking at night, visibility is still important. My wife has a special vest that has lights built into it for visibility, but I don't. Then I remembered that I have a bunch of those Christmas light necklaces that have little bulbs all around them, and they light up. That would make me visible at night. So now, when I go on a walk at night, I bring a little Christmas spirit with me, so people can see me and my Christmas spirit. So if you're going on a walk and you're worried about visibility, why not dig one of your Christmas light necklaces out of storage before you go? Let the magic of Christmas keep you safe.
Maybe you shouldn't be encouraging people to walk in the dark even with these necklaces. I'm no lawyer, but that seems like a liability issue.
Good point. I guess I should say that this has worked for me personally, but I don't know that it's actually a good idea. Maybe the area I walk in is safer than others, since I walk basically in a park for most of my walk, and there's not a ton of traffic, but I don't know. It's something I do, and I thought I'd share. Proceed with caution. Speaking of proceeding, let's proceed to our next segment, 5 Golden Things.
5 Golden Things.
All year, I'm turning my countdown feature over to the other talented and merry hosts in the Christmas Podcast Network. Last time, we had Robert from the Behind the Bells podcast. And if you haven't heard the April episode, let me tell you, he went whole hog. That was a long version of that segment. He put a lot of effort into it, so you should go back and listen to that. But not yet! Not yet! Stay right where you are right now. Put that on your queue for next. But right now, we've got Ken from the Sounds of Christmas podcast, who not only did a great list for us, he also edited in his own fun music and sound effects. So, take it away, Ken.
Hi, I'm Ken from the Sounds of Christmas station and podcast, and Tim has invited me to join his podcast today for 5 Golden Things. And today, my 5 Golden Things are my picks for the top 5 Christmas movies where music is essential to the story. I know that's a mouthful, but music is really what the Sounds of Christmas station and podcast are all about. Christmas music, specifically. Of course. Now, to be clear, these are not necessarily the movies with the best music or the best soundtracks. It's a list of Christmas movies where, if it weren't for the music, these movies just wouldn't have happened. The music is not just in the background, it's important to the plot. And as far as I'm concerned, there just wouldn't be a movie without it. So let's get started.
Number five is Alive.
Number five.
Number five on my list is Elf. Elf was not a musical, of course. And for it to fit on this list, you might think I'm referring to the scene in the ladies' locker room where Will Ferrell joined Zooey Deschanel in a version of Baby, It's Cold Outside. While that scene did give the song a short-lived revival, it's hardly essential to the plot. There's a much more significant scene where music plays an important role. Since this movie just celebrated its 20th anniversary, I don't think what follows can really be considered a spoiler. Early in the film, Buddy says,
"The best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud for all to hear."
And that really saves the day at the end when everyone, including Buddy's dad, sings Santa Claus is Coming to Town. Singing that song raises the level of Christmas spirit, allowing Santa's sleigh to fly. Without music in that climactic scene, there would be no resolution in the movie.
"You're not singing."
"Yes, I am."
"No, you're not. You're just moving your lips."
"What's the big deal?"
"Dad,
Santa Claus is coming to town."
Buddy mentioned several times that they sing at the North Pole all the time, even when his boss at Gimbel's insists there's no singing at their North Pole. Okay, I know Buddy doesn't really work there, so it isn't really his boss, but you know what I mean. So, on to number four. Number four is The Nightmare Before Christmas. I'm not here to argue about whether this is a Halloween movie or a Christmas movie. Personally, I think it's both. From the opening song that welcomes you to Halloween Town, music sets the stage for the story and is intertwined with the action every step of the way.
Something like this. How about it? Think you can manage?
A one and a two and a three and...
Next!
Fantastic! Now, why don't you all practice on that, and we'll be in great shape.
How important is the music from Nightmare Before Christmas? This Is Halloween has been covered by dozens of artists, including Marilyn Manson, Panic at the Disco, and even Disney's own group, Di Cappella. What's This has been covered by lots of artists too, including Fall Out Boy, Flyleaf, and Voiceplay. And Oogie Boogie's song has been covered by Tiger Army, Jonathan Young, and Vitamin String Quartet, who actually recorded an instrumental version of it. There have been several versions of the soundtrack released since the movie originally came out in 1993. In fact, just last year, a new version was produced, restoring the original opening narration from Patrick Stewart. Okay, that last part doesn't really have anything to do with the music, but I thought it was kind of cool and worth mentioning.
The holidays are the result of much fuss and hard work from the worlds that create them for us. Well, you see now, quite simply, that's all that they do, making one unique holiday especially for you. But once a calamity ever so great occurred when two holidays met by mistake.
So the music is significant on its own merits, but what about the movie? Well, aside from the opening, almost every plot point takes place in song. Jack is restless and feeling lost. He sings Jack's Lament. He discovers Christmas Town. He sings What's This? He conveys his idea to the townspeople about changing Halloween to something resembling Christmas, and they sing Making Christmas. Jack plans to kidnap Santa and sends Oogie's boys to get him. They sing Kidnap the Sandy Claus. We finally meet the villain, Oogie Boogie, and as most villains do, he monologues, but in song, obviously entitled Oogie Boogie's Song. Virtually no scene in the entire movie takes place without musical accompaniment, if not entirely done as a musical number. There would be no Nightmare Before Christmas without music. On to number three.
Number three will shock you.
Number three on my list is Spirited.
I don't think they're expecting Elf.
Yes, they are. Instead, they're getting a musical from two guys with questionable pitch.
Hey.
Sorry.
It's okay.
This is easy. Some simple disclaimers. Hey, everyone. Spirited is not Elf. It's not Deadpool either. It is a musical. It is funny.
This is the newest movie on my list. It's a musical starring Will Ferrell and Ryan Reynolds that was in theaters for about a week in 2022 before finding a home on Apple TV. This one is classified as a musical comedy, so obviously music is key to the entire film, which I don't think would have worked without it. And for those who don't know, it's more of a sequel to A Christmas Carol than another adaptation of it.
Like A Christmas Carol? The Dickens story? The Bill Murray movie with Bobcat Goldthwait?
Yes, yes, like the Dickens book and the Bill Murray movie and every other adaptation nobody asked for.
Aside from the wealth of original songs, including That Christmas Morning Feeling and Bringing Back Christmas, it features groups of characters whose sole purpose seems to be a mix of song and dance. And those musical numbers are directly tied into each person whose soul they are trying to save. In fact, in one of the first trailers for the movie, Will Ferrell lays out the importance of music.
Do people really change? I mean, real, lasting, positive change? I sure hope so, because that's what we do. And then we sing about it.
Spirited, as a movie, couldn't work without the music. And now, number two.
Number two.
Number two.
Number two on my list is Love Actually. Of the multiple storylines in this movie, two needed the music as part of their stories, and one other has a minor plot line where music, well, it doesn't drive the plot, and is significant. First is the obvious plot of former rock star Billy Mack, who begins the movie in a studio re-recording one of his previous songs with new lyrics to make it a Christmas song. His journey in promoting the song and the song's journey up the charts highlight the relationship he has with his manager/friend Joe, a story that couldn't be told without the music.
This must be a very exciting moment for you, fighting for the Christmas number one. How's it looking so far?
Very bad indeed. Blue are outselling me 5-1, but I'm hoping for a late surge. And if I reach number one, I promise to sing the song stark naked on TV on Christmas Eve.
Second is the storyline of Daniel and his stepson, Sam. While they grieve the recent death of Daniel's wife, Sam's mom, Sam falls in love with a girl at his school and thinks that becoming a drummer is what he needs to do to win her. He winds up playing drums for her song in the school Christmas pageant, which was also one of the first covers of Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You.
Girls love musicians, don't they?
Uh-huh.
Even the really weird ones get girlfriends.
That's right. Ringo Starr married a Bond girl.
Whatever. There's this big concert at the end of term, and Joanna's in it. And I thought maybe if I was in the band and played absolutely superbly, there's a chance that she might actually fall in love with me. What do you think?
I think it's brilliant. I think it's stellar. Apart from the one obvious tiny little baby, little hiccup.
They don't play musical instrument.
Yes, sir.
A tiny, insignificant detail.
And finally, to a lesser extent, is Karen's love for the music of Joni Mitchell, which is sadly underscored when her husband gives her a Joni Mitchell CD for Christmas, leading her to know the jewelry gift she had found in his coat pocket was being given to someone else.
What is this we're listening to?
Joni Mitchell.
I can't believe you still listen to Joni Mitchell.
I love her, and true love lasts a lifetime. Joni Mitchell is the woman who taught your cold English wife how to feel.
And number one.
Rule number one, you will not touch anything.
Number one, he hates bright lights. We know that.
Number one, number one, number one, number one.
We're number one. We're number one.
And now we're up to the new number one.
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 Number one.
1954's White Christmas.
The two greatest figures in show business, Bing and Danny, as two ex-GIs who form the perfect partnership. Rosemary and Vera Ellen as the sisters who have them in a spin. With Dean Jagger as the unemployed general they take under their wing.
Apparently, there's still quite a bit about show business I don't understand.
Oh, it'll come to you, sir. Just takes time. We wouldn't be any good as generals.
You weren't any good as privates.
A wonderful story that will warm your hearts. Just as the breathtaking scope of a new screen wonder will widen your eyes. White Christmas in VistaVision.
The movie begins with Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye performing in a soldier show during World War II. After the war, they work together as performers and producers. Then they team up with Rosemary Clooney and Vera Allen to perform shows at a Vermont inn run by Bing and Danny's former commanding officer. The entire movie is a showcase of some of Irving Berlin's finest work, including Bing's new recording of the title song and the Oscar-nominated song Count Your Blessings Instead of Sheep.
That song is for the 151st Division. The officers and the men under the command of Major General Tom Waverly. I hope a lot of you guys were listening, because I have something I want you to do for me.
Since the movie is about performers, revolves around their performances, and is, in fact, based on the music of Irving Berlin, there's no way the movie could exist without the music.
We seem to be getting a little mixed up.
Maybe it's the music.
Maybe it isn't only the music.
So there are my picks for the top five Christmas movies where the Christmas music is essential to the story. Again, I'm Ken Kessler from The Sounds of Christmas. The podcast focuses on Christmas and Christmas music, mostly. The station plays the best variety of Christmas music all year long. Well, except in October, when I play the best variety of Halloween music. And you can find both the station and the podcast at soundsofchristmas.com. Thanks again, Tim, for inviting me to share a little musical Christmas spirit with your audience.
Thank you, Ken. That was a great musical journey through Christmas movie magic. If you'd like to hear more of Ken on his podcast, Sounds of Christmas, I've put a link to it in the show notes of this episode. And now, since it's May, which is the traditional kickoff to the Hollywood summer movie season, I'm going to keep the movie talk going by bringing back our long-lost segment,
Is It a Christmas Movie?
So far, we've answered this question for Die Hard, The Nightmare Before Christmas, and Die Hard 2. Today, we'll be turning our attention to a little movie from 1984, Gremlins.
Steven Spielberg presents Gremlins. They're clever. They're mischievous. They'll get into the kitchen, the basement, the garage. They'll get into anything. And once they get in,
that's a real gremlin in my camp!
You're in for it. Gremlins. They'll be expecting you. Directed by Joe Dante, rated PG.
If you follow us on Instagram or Facebook, you know that I was midway through researching this movie for today's show when I realized I don't think I've seen this since it was in theaters. I only remembered a handful of things about it. I remember they took a photo of Gizmo early on and he jumped away yelling, "Bright light!"
Wait, Gizmo? Who is Gizmo?
We'll get there. We'll get there. I remember them exploding a gremlin in the microwave. I remember the gremlins making a lady's stairlift chair go super fast and rocketing her out her top floor window. And I remember the gremlins ripping up the movie screen at a showing of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. But I gotta say, most of the rest of the movie, I didn't remember at all. So I'll go through the plot briefly, in case you're like me and don't remember much of it, before we really dive into the making of the movie. The story starts when Randall, played by Hoyt Axton, is trying to find a Christmas gift for his son, Billy, played by Zach Galligan. His search takes him to a mysterious shop in Chinatown, where he finds a small little creature called a Mogwai. The shop owner won't sell it to him, but the shop owner's grandson sneaks it out to Randall and gives him an important set of rules to follow regarding this strange little creature.
Look, mister. There's three rules you've got to follow.
Yeah, what kind of rules?
Keep him out of the light. He hates bright light, especially sunlight. It'll kill him. And keep him away from water. Don't get him wet. But the most important rule, the rule you can never forget, no matter how much he cries, no matter how much he begs, never, never feed him after midnight. You got it?
Sure, kid, whatever you say. Hey, listen, thanks, and have a Merry Christmas.
Then we're actually introduced to Billy, who works at a bank with Kate, played by Phoebe Cates. She's a young lady who hates Christmas for a very dark reason that we don't find out until later in the movie. I wasn't quite sure if Kate and Billy are a couple when we first meet them, but spoiler alert, they are the male and female leads and this was an 80s movie, they're going to be a couple by the end. We also meet some of the other characters in Kingston Falls, like Murray, Billy's emphatically xenophobic neighbor, played by Dick Miller, Mrs. Deagle, the mean rich lady in town, played by Polly Holiday, and Pete, Billy's oddly young best friend, played by a fresh-faced Corey Feldman. Finally, Billy comes home, and we meet his mom, Lynn, played by Frances Lee McCain. Then his dad arrives and gives him the gift of the Mogwai. That had to be intentional, right? Anyway, they name him Gizmo, and we get the first scene I remember. Mom takes a flash photo, and Gizmo jumps into Dad's arms, yelling, "Bright light!" By the way, Gizmo is voiced by comedian Howie Mandel in one of his first ever voice acting roles. He was encouraged to come in an audition by legendary voice actor Frank Welker, who does the voice of the evil gremlin Stripe later on. But, getting ahead of myself, back to this scene, where after Gizmo jumps into Dad's arms, Dad lays out the three rules again. No light. no getting them wet, and no food after midnight. And before we go on, can we acknowledge that the rules make no sense? I know people, including Gremlins 2, pointed out that the feeding after midnight rule has flaws, and we'll get there, but all of the rules break down if you think about them too long. First off, the no bright light rule. Bright is a very nebulous term. How much light is too much? Gizmo doesn't appear to be able to see in the dark, so he needs light to navigate the world. Yet that light can also kill him? How do you know when you've crossed the threshold from, oh, I can see where I'm going, to, ah, it burns, it burns? Also, he has fur all over his body that covers his skin. Shouldn't that block out the light from affecting him? Then there's the no getting wet rule. I call naughty list on this one.
Call naughty list? Is that a thing?
It is now. First of all living things need water, so how can the Mogwai survive without it? But leaving that aside, what about other liquids? Will they have the same effect? Like, most juices have water in them. So if you're drinking juice, you're still drinking water. Will that have the same effect as water? Later in the movie, the gremlins are seen walking through the snow. Isn't snow just frozen water? Wouldn't that have the same effect? How does it work? Finally, the often discussed no food after midnight rule. It's all fine and dandy in Kingston Falls, but what if Gizmo goes to another time zone? Is the new midnight at the new time zone the cutoff point, or is it always when it's midnight at Kingston Falls? Also, when can you start feeding them again? Because technically, every time is after a midnight. When does it go from after last midnight to before next midnight? Sunrise? What if the Mogwai is in one of those parts of Alaska where the sun doesn't come up for 60 days? The filmmakers were actually worried that these rules might be weird and take the audience out of it, but apparently no one noticed till a guy did a podcast 4 years later. Okay, side tangent over, back to the story. Of course, Billy immediately breaks one of the three rules when he angles a hand mirror and reflects a bright light at Gizmo's face that somehow burns the top of his head. A few scenes later, Billy's buddy Pete comes over and spills water on Gizmo, and five more Mogwai pop out of him. While Gizmo is cute and sweet, these Mogwai are immediately jerks. Billy takes one to a middle school biology teacher in a plot thread I had 100% forgotten about until I saw this movie again, where he's going to do blood tests and experiment on the thing to try and figure out what it is. That night, the naughty Mogwai unplug Billy's clock and trick him into feeding them after midnight. Also, the middle school biology teacher leaves the sandwich unattended, and that Mogwai also eats after midnight. By morning, they've all turned into these gross-looking pod things, which eventually hatch into these reptilian-looking gremlins. One of them even takes out the biology teacher. But while Billy's out of the house, his mom takes out three of them by herself in the kitchen, including exploding one gremlin in the microwave in the scene I mentioned earlier. Billy comes home as she's in mid-battle with a fourth one, and he lops that one's head off. Now there's only one left of the gremlins from Billy's house. The lone gremlin, Stripe, escapes and finds a swimming pool and jumps in. Now there are hundreds of gremlins attacking the town. Billy goes to the cops, who don't believe him until it's too late, and some of the gremlins cut the police cruiser's brake lines. They also run over the xenophobic neighbor Murray with his own snowplow. They rewire the nasty Mrs. Deagle's staircase chair so that instead of a slow, smooth ride up the stairs, it rockets her up the stairs at high speed until she flies out the window, in the third scene that I remember from seeing this as a kid. Billy goes to where Kate works her night job, the local bar, to find the bar crawling with gremlins, and Kate trying to keep them from attacking her by giving them plenty of alcohol and snacks. She eventually escapes using a flash camera that keeps the gremlins back. While she and Billy regroup, she tells an awful story of why she hates Christmas that involves her dad dying on Christmas in a very tragic way that I'm not going to get into on this podcast. But after a while, they notice they don't hear the gremlins anymore. It's getting close to sunrise, and they realize they're probably hiding somewhere dark. They check the local movie theater, and sure enough, they're all hiding in there watching Disney's Snow White. Which is crazy that Disney gave them the rights to that movie. I don't know who worked what magic behind the scenes, but you could never see that kind of thing in a movie these days. Anyway, Billy and Kate decide to blow up the movie theater to get rid of all the gremlins at once. The gremlins catch on partway through the plan and start chasing Billy and Kate, ripping through the movie screen to try to get to them in the final scene I remember from watching this as a kid. Billy and Kate escape, blow up the theater, but one gremlin has escaped, the main one, Stripe. They chase him into a department store where he and Billy battle with chainsaws and bats and crossbows, all while Kate tries to get the store lights on. Then Stripe finds a water fountain and jumps in, but just as he does, Gizmo drives a Barbie dream car in to open a skylight that shines directly on Stripe and destroys him in a long, kinda gross scene. The dad comes back from his inventor's convention. Oh, did I mention the dad was a really awful inventor and he went off to a convention? Well, he was, and he did. But then, the shop owner from Chinatown comes back and takes Gizmo back, and that's the end of Gremlins.
I warned you, with Mogwai comes much responsibility. But you didn't listen. And you see what happens.
I didn't mean it.
You do with Mokwai what your society has done with all of nature's gifts. You do not understand. You are not ready.
So before we answer the question, is Gremlins a Christmas movie, let's look at its journey to the screen. It starts with writer Chris Columbus, who also wrote other Christmas movies like Christmas with the Cranks and Christmas Chronicles 2, and he directed the first two Home Alone movies, Christmas Chronicles 2, and the first two Harry Potter movies. But this was way before any of this. Chris hadn't had much success yet. In fact, he was living in a crappy apartment that had mice that would brush by his fingers when he slept and freak him out. That was the seed for the idea of these little terrifying creatures. And initially, they were much more terrifying. The original script was a much darker movie. The gremlins go to McDonald's and eat all the people but leave all the food. And the scene that gave me nightmares as a kid, where Billy's mom microwaves that gremlin to death, would have been way worse, because the mom doesn't survive that encounter, and in fact her head comes rolling down the stairs at one point. But even in this darker stage, Chris said that he drew a lot of inspiration from an unlikely source, It's a Wonderful Life. Kingston Falls is similar in some ways to Bedford Falls, the city from It's a Wonderful Life. Billy has dreams that he has got to put on hold for his family, much like George Bailey. Though Billy's dreams are to be a comic book artist, which doesn't really pay off in the final movie as a lot of that stuff was cut between rewrites and editing. Also, once you realize the It's a Wonderful Life connection, it becomes clear that Mrs. Deagle is a clear stand-in for Mr. Potter. And that makes it much more satisfying to see her launched out of her house by a mechanical chair, because we all would have loved to see that happen to Mr. Potter at the end of It's a Wonderful Life. There's a lot of stuff in the film that harkens back to earlier drafts, like the thing about Billy being a comic book artist. Like, he's drawing all these things where a guy is battling these monsters, and then by the end, he starts to look like the character he's been drawing all this time. Then there's a character played by Judge Reinhold, who's also in the Santa Claus movies. He has two scenes as a materialistic 80s jerk towards the beginning, and then just disappears from the movie. He was supposed to get some comeuppance for being a jerk, but they really just never see him again. And initially, Billy was much younger, which is why in the final film he's friends with a random 12-year-old Corey Feldman. But this darker, more violent original script wasn't necessarily intended to be a movie. It was just a way for Chris Columbus to demonstrate his writing ability. It wound up on the desk of a new production company, Amblin Entertainment, and its head honcho, Steven Spielberg. Steven saw potential in Gremlins, but he was getting ready to direct Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, so he had to find someone else to direct Gremlins. So he turned to the director of The Howling, Joe Dante. Joe recalls that he was a bit down on his luck at the time and running low on money, so much so that when he got the script sent to him by Steven Spielberg, he assumed it must have been a mistake and sent to the wrong person. But Steven had picked Joe intentionally because he wanted to make Gremlins in a low-budget horror way. But as they realized how much money and technology it would take to bring the Gremlins to life, that's when Steven softened the movie, because he knew to get a bigger budget, the movie would need to be more accessible for a wider audience. One of Steven's first changes was Gizmo. In the original script, the Mogwai multiplies, and all of them turn into Gremlins. Steven had the idea of one Mogwai staying a Mogwai through the whole movie and being Billy's sidekick. Speaking of Gizmo, he and the other Mogwai and Gremlins took a lot of work to bring to life. Chris Wallace, who created the Gremlins, talked about the process in an interview he did back in 2016. He said, "Gizmo was a real challenge. The small size of the Mogwai made it difficult to come up with mechanical puppets that would have enough features to keep the puppet alive on film. We just couldn't get away with most standard puppet techniques at that small size, so most of the Mogwai were largely animatronic, as opposed to the Gremlins. The Gremlins were specifically designed to be hand puppets, and the majority of them were relatively simple puppets that were enjoyable to operate. There were lots of specialized puppets that only did one thing, crawl, skateboard, hang from lights, etc. These were all unique and limited puppets that only performed a single function. We made a lot of puppets on that film, so many that an accurate guess at a number is not really feasible, especially since we cannibalized a lot of them to create new puppets along the way. The show was pretty crazy, and we never knew what we would be shooting the next day, so my approach was to have a parts library on hand. That way, if something came up that we weren't prepared for, we could just create a new puppet for that use overnight if necessary." I also read that apparently they were pretty far along in the design for Gizmo when Steven Spielberg had an additional challenge to make Gizmo the same color as his Cocker Spaniel. And one of the things they had to do was make several different gizmos. There were ones that couldn't be moved because of all the controls and cords coming out of them. They could move their arms and turn their head, but they had to be bolted in place. And they couldn't change their facial expressions, so what they would do is make different faces and swap them out between scenes. So they had a cute face, a worried face, a sad face, but even that wasn't enough. They also created a huge gizmo head for close-ups. Since it was bigger, they were able to animate its features more. They could articulate its mouth, and it was able to change expressions on camera. Then there was a remote control gizmo that stayed in Billy's backpack. backpack. It's fun to watch when Billy's holding Gizmo and then puts him down. He always puts him down off camera, and then the camera pans down to Gizmo, because the one Billy was holding is not the one that can move. So Billy sets him down, and they swap out the portable Gizmo for the one that's bolted to the set and able to be controlled. Once you know that, it's fun to spot all the times it happens in the movie. Then there was the town of Kingston Falls. There was talk of shooting in a real city, but Joe Dante felt that shooting on a set or a studio backlot would give the movie a feel of the older films like It's a Wonderful Life that it was trying to invoke. Plus, he felt the Gremlins would be less believable in the real world. So they used the Warner Studios backlot for a lot of scenes, since this was a Warner Brothers movie, but they also had to shoot some of the town on the Universal Studios backlot. Specifically, the street that Billy is running down when he is late for work is the exact same street Marty McFly drives down a year later to get Back to the Future. In fact, the theater they built, where the Gremlins watch Snow White, is the same theater that the DeLorean crashes into when it arrives back in 1985. But despite the cute little Gizmo and the quaint town of Kingston Falls, there is definitely some dark parts to this movie, despite Steven Spielberg's attempts to make it more audience-friendly. I'd like to talk about two major dark spots specifically. The first is Phoebe Cates' speech about her dad dying on Christmas. It's somehow both bleak and ridiculous at the same time, and the day they shot it, the editor said to the director, "That will never make it in the final movie." And sure enough, the studio kept trying to get Joe to cut the scene. They were sure that people would walk out. They tried to get Steven Spielberg to convince Joe Dante to cut it out, but Joe stuck to his guns, and Steven went to bat for him with the studio, and it stayed in. And sure enough, people didn't walk out. In fact, it's one of those scenes, even though I personally didn't remember, I know it has stuck in popular culture. It's one of the more famous monologues from a movie. The other dark scene that I've mentioned a couple times already is when Billy's mom explodes a gremlin in the microwave. Apparently, it wasn't just young Tim who was disturbed by that scene. It was one of the scenes that almost got Gremlins an R rating. Back then, there was no rating between PG and R. But after this movie and Spielberg's other 1984 movie, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, the Motion Picture Association of America added a new rating, PG-13. So Gremlins came out, and it was one of the top grossing movies of 1984, which is saying something. Because 1984 was stacked with big movies, like the aforementioned Temple of Doom, Beverly Hills Cop, The Terminator, The Karate Kid, 16 Candles, Police Academy, Footloose, Revenge of the Nerds, Star Trek III, The Muppets Take Manhattan, Nightmare on Elm Street, and even a little movie that came out the exact same day as Gremlins, Ghostbusters. Despite all those heavy hitters coming out the same year, Gremlins still finished at the top of the pack. And it's a movie that is much beloved to this day. And so now we must circle back to the question that started this segment. Is Gremlins a Christmas movie? Well, its origins involve one of the all-time great Christmas movies, It's a Wonderful Life. The trappings of Christmas are present throughout the movie, songs, decor, not to mention that the thing that gets the action of the movie going is the giving of a Christmas gift. And you can't deny it's earned an iconic place in pop culture. Even people who've never seen it know about the rules about Gremlins. There's certain movie rules that everyone knows, like you don't talk about Fight Club, you don't say I'll be right back in a horror movie, you don't cross the streams, and you don't feed a gremlin after midnight. The movie bookends with a family together celebrating Christmas, and you could even argue it has a Linus moment at the end when the shopkeeper comes back and takes Gizmo back.
Bye, Billy.
Perhaps someday, you may be ready. Until then, Mogwai will be waiting.
But all the violence and the gross gremlins and the dark story about Kate's dad certainly don't put you in a Christmassy mood. But while I was talking about this movie with my mom, she said something that I thought was perfect. She said, "Sure, it's a Christmas movie. I just don't like it." And that's the thing. There are all types of Christmas movies. Some make you laugh, some make you cry, some make you fall in love, and some scare the tinsel out of you. We all gravitate to the Christmas movies that speak to us. And as of this recording, I've never shown this to my kids. But I did leave the Blu-ray lying around, and now my youngest wants to see it. Will he like it? Will he have nightmares like his dad did? Who knows? So while this is certainly not part of my yearly Christmas movie watching tradition, I'd have to say Gremlins is a Christmas movie. It's certainly not your traditional peace on earth, goodwill towards men Christmas movie, and my mom definitely hates it. But even she acknowledges, it's still a Christmas movie.
Well, that's a story. So if your air conditioner goes on the fritz, or your washing machine blows up, or your video recorder conks out, before you call the repairman, turn on all the lights, check all the closets and cupboards, look under all the beds, because you never can tell. There just might be a gremlin in your house.
And that's our show. Thank you for listening, and thanks once again to Ken from the Sounds of Christmas podcast for doing our 5 golden things. Be sure to check out the link to his show in the show notes. When you next hear from me, we will be halfway to Christmas, which means that the anniversary listener special is just around the corner. Send me your emails and social media DMs now for what you'd like us to talk about in our July episode. Give us your Christmas Now tips, your ideas for a main story, let me know at christmas@tancast.com now that I've got all that spam filtered out of my inbox. Okay, hope to hear from you soon, and until next time, Yule Believers, keep laughing all the way.
And that was Christmas 1983.
Actually, Dad, it's 2024.
Oh.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Can't Wait for Christmas podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Remember, if you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, aka iTunes, and email us about it at christmas@tancast.com, we'll send you a free Can't Wait for Christmas sticker. If you'd like to see the show notes or leave a comment on this or any other episodes, you can go to our official website, can'twaitforchristmaspod.com. While you're there, you'll find a link to our official Zazzle store, where you can grab customizable t-shirts, ornaments, stickers, and all sorts of other Christmas-themed items all year long. We'd love to connect with you on social media. On TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, we are Can't Wait for Christmas Pod. And on the app formerly known as Twitter, we are @ChristmasPod. We Wish You a Merry Christmas was performed by the United States Marine Corps Band, and this amazing version of Jingle Bells on the accordion was performed by the wonderful and talented Christian Nowicki. All other music and sounds used in this episode are the properties of their individual copyright holders, and they are used for purposes of commentary and review. No infringement is intended. Okay, boys, did I forget anything?
God bless us, everyone.
Merry Christmas!
I remember the gremlins making a lady's stairlift chair go fast and rocking her out. I remember the gremlins making a lady's stairlift chair go super fast and rocketing her out her top window. That is hard to say. That is hard to say. It is hard to say. The story starts with Randall, played by Hoyt Axton. The story starts when Randall, played by Hoyt Axton, is trying to find a Christmas gift for his son, Billy, played by Zach. When you're fumbling on the first sentence of the story, you know it's going to be a rough record. We also meet some of the other characters in Kingston Falls, like Murray, Billy's emphatically xenophobic neighbor. Emphatically xenophobic. Once again, things that are easy to type, but hard to say. I'm like George Lucas when I write these scripts. The filmmakers were actually worried that these rules didn't make sense when you looked at them too closely, but fortunately, apparently no one noticed it till some guy did a podcast 30 years later. 40 years later. It's 40 years later. Gremlins is 40 years old. That's crazy. Billy comes home as it's...